Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. This is Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You. And I got to tell you, I'm really excited about our guest today, Dr. Eric Gentry. He is author of several books, and he is CEO of Compassion Unlimited. And I don't even want to try to tell you all the stuff he's doing, what he does, and what he's done for me on a very personal level is just immense. And I hope we get to talk about some of that while we have him here today. Eric, good morning, and how you doing?
I'm pleased and privileged to be on here with you, Johnny.
It's been a long road for us, man. It's been a long road for us. That is for sure. I think I met you in 2007 when I was in an absolute insane part of my life. I was so embedded in depression and anxiety and panic attacks. And somebody suggested you to me, and I was at the point in my life where I was going to take whatever suggestion I was given because I knew I didn't know what I needed to do. And I was directed to you, and what happened for me after that was just an absolute miracle.
Well, I am privileged to have been able to play that role in your life, Johnny.
Well, I'm gonna give a little bit of that history because it's such an incredible story. I think it was the second or third time I was with you, and I was crying my eyes out, and I was reporting to you how insane my mind was, but still trying to hold on to something to be proud of. So I was telling you how long I'd been in 12-step recovery, how many Course in Miracles classes I had taught. I'd written a book, and at the same time, I was crying profusely, suicidal as I could be. And when I was through, I will never forget. You looked at me with a little bit of a smirk on, and you said, man, you are not going to like what I got to say. And I had just enough mind left that I said, that probably means I really need to hear it. And you said, man, you don't know who God is. And until you get God in this mix, you're going to stay freaking nuts. I just lightened that up a little bit. And you said, because you cannot beat what you're up against without him in this. So then you said something that I don't know if anybody else ever would have said to me. You said, I was living at a homeless shelter at the time. I was 16 years without drugs or alcohol, and I was living in a homeless shelter. And you said, I suggest you go back to the shelter, and you sit down and you write a letter to you from God. And I didn't even question it. I said, okay. And I ended up writing those letters every day for over 5 years. And when I came back the next week and I had written 7 of them, you said, man, you really are an addict. I told you to write a letter. But those letters absolutely changed my life, Eric. And I will never be able to thank you enough for the work you did with me.
Well, it seems like that you are doing the absolute best thing in repayment of that you could. And you're paying it forward and you're changing the world yourself and offering service to a whole lot of people. And that's exactly what I would have hoped would have happened.
Well, you led me by demonstration in that regard. So the title of our show here is Morph Into a New You. It's about changing our mind so we can change our life. And pretty much what we try to do on this show is combine psychology and spirituality. And give me your thoughts on that and how the two work together.
I've thought about that a little bit since you asked me to be on the show. And I guess a little bit of my history. I got certified as an addictions counselor 25 years ago. And have been worked the first several years of my career in addiction. And as I climbed the addiction mountain, I ran residential treatments and programs and did a lot of outpatient work. But what I started finding pretty consistently was trauma and the interweave between trauma and addiction. So I went on, you know, over the next, the past 20 years or so, I've specialized, and that's become kind of my nest, is working with trauma, and have run several trauma training programs and write about trauma. And it's really interesting about the intersection of what trauma does to a human being. I would say that addiction is an outcome of trauma. And trauma does a lot to a person, but the biggest deal that it does, two things that it does, one of them, it's diagnostic for post-traumatic stress disorder, but it takes away hope. You know, after a person has been traumatized, they lose hope. Hope is painful. Hope is scary. And hope sets a person up to be vulnerable and get hurt again. So they cut off their access to positive expectancy, to a sense of hope, to a second step. They just can't get it because it demands too much from them, too much vulnerability. Paired with that, the other thing that trauma does, and this is the most insidious, is that, you know, after a person's been traumatized, what happens to them is that they perceive a much more dangerous world. That's the impact. Is before trauma, a person sees a safe world, a world where they can get their needs met, where people are basically good, where they can function however they want to function. And then after they get traumatized, there is what follows in that wake is hypervigilance, is a sense of constantly perceiving threat everywhere in one's periphery. And what that does is that just jacks a person up. It activates their autonomic nervous system. So they're walking around all the time in a state of dis-ease. And that state of dis-ease and hypervigilance, what that does is it shuts down their ability to connect to spirit. They just can't do it. It's an isolatory shutdown. And so part of what we do when we work with trauma is we try to open that up. One of the quotes that is just really precious to me is from Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl has taught me everything I know about hope. And he says, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to make choices. And in our choices lie our growth and our freedom. And what happens to folks who come into my office to get treatment is that they're so jacked up and they're so hypervigilant that their space is collapsed, that they have stimulus, the stuff that they encounter in the world. And because they're so jacked up and so hypervigilant, they just have an immediate reactive behavior. I was 30 years old before I realized I didn't have to fight when somebody disrespected me. You know, it just produced, somebody said something disrespectful to me, and it just produced an aggressive response that was just, it was seared in to my development growing up in Southern West Virginia. You know, it just was, it was what you did, that somebody disrespected you and you turned to them aggressively. I didn't have any space between stimulus and response. And, you know, after I got clean and began working a program, That's what happened, was that as I began to surrender instead of fight, as I began to relax, I started to be able to have some space between stimulus and response. And I started to be able to say, you know, how do I want to be when people are disrespecting me? How do I want to act? What I've learned in 25 years of research is that a human being, when they are perceiving that threat and when their autonomic nervous system is way jacked up, they just don't have a frontal lobe. They don't have the ability in that moment to, no matter how intelligent they are, they just can't get to the hardware to be able to talk to themselves, to be able to have a connection with God, to be able to access spirit. It's impossible to do because survival has trumped intention. Survival, the felt sense of that I'm going to die, leads to that desperation. And so to help people to begin to move into accessing spirit and to be able to use spirituality, all of the gifts of accessing and utilizing spirit and spirituality, they got to learn to regulate their autonomic nervous systems. And what's the last thing I'll say is that 12 steps just do that in a lovely way, you know, because you think about in a 12-step fellowship, an addict's been trying to stop getting high for all these years, you know, and they sit on their hands and they fight and they fight and they get to the end of the day and they say, screw it, give me a hit. And they go to the dope man's house. They go to the ABC store. They can't stop themselves. And then they go to a 12-step meeting and somebody says, bro, surrender, surrender, let go, stop fighting. And they have their first night of navigating all the way to sleep without picking up. That's the miracle
that is.
Of 12-step fellowship, is that it teaches kind of through spirit, through spirituality, a really important cognitive behavioral approach, which is to that thing's called reciprocal inhibition, is to confront the things that scare you with a relaxed body. And what that does is it makes the world a less dangerous place, because you are taking the charge out of all that stuff, that so it doesn't overwhelm or it doesn't scare you nearly as badly the more that you are surrendered.
Wow, Eric, that is so loaded. There's so much in there that I can relate to and identify with that I've used. Thank you. I know for myself, having survived and lived with a lot of post-traumatic stress from my childhood, that the world was not a safe place for me to be in. And every stimulus that you mentioned was met with a reaction, an immediate reaction, no thought whatsoever, which is one of the things I love that I was given early on in my 12-step work, was think it through. Now, in the beginning, that's just about the drugs and the alcohol. But eventually, that becomes about, okay, do I really want to knock this guy out now because he's disrespected me, to go on what you said? Do I really want to steal from this guy? Because, and I became capable of saying, no, I don't want the consequences that come with that. And today, it's transformed into like almost everything that I encounter. How do I want to react to it? I have said for years, prior to my introduction to the 12 steps, I didn't think anything through. I had thoughts that were immediately followed with events. There was no like, well, if I break into that house, am I really willing to go to jail? And so there was no thinking it through. And today I can do that. And today, because I've done it for so long, my instant response is to think it through. What is this action going to create? So I could really relate to everything you were saying, and that space, I never thought of it in the context that you just put it in, but that space between stimulus and response.
Isn't that beautiful?
Oh man, it's incredible, because in that place I get to, and it's not so much an effort anymore, but in that place I get to talk to God. And to my source, I don't care what you call it, God, Billy Bob, I don't care what you call it. But that thing for me that connects me to something bigger than me, in that space, I can be like, you know, there's probably a kinder and a gentler and a more loving way that I can respond to this than poking a hole in this guy's tires. Because before it was about, you couldn't disrespect me without there being a retaliation. So I really appreciated the way you put all of that.
Neat. It's pretty cool stuff that, you know, one of the things that's happened, I've done a good deal of research and have published a lot over the past several years, and consider myself to be maybe one of the 100 people out on the front end of the spear of evolving our field forward, especially treating traumatic stress. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen is that, you know, for a whole lot of years, I was an anxious therapist with a lot of means. Some means, not a lot, but some means. And I did what therapists with some means do, is I got certified in everything. Every alphabet therapy that you've ever heard of, I'm certified in and can teach most of them. EMDR, TIR, TFT, DBT, NLP, you know, all of that stuff. Because I was anxious and I wanted to have a pot full of pasta that I could sling at my clients hoping something would stick. You know, and it was all about me. I mean, I wasn't treating my clients to get them better. I was treating my clients to manage my own anxiety, my own failing sense of worth, that if I could help somebody else, then maybe I'd be okay. Thank God I've stayed in this field long enough that I have matured into true altruism. But what's really interesting for me is after, you know, 2 doctorates and all of that professional development, more than $100,000 worth of professional development, more than 80% of what I do today with clients is something a paraprofessional could do.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Something a paraprofessional could do, that what I do does not require an advanced degree. that what I do is I teach my clients how to confront the perceived threats of their lives in a relaxed muscle body.
Wow.
And to start to get it that my clients' distress have nothing to do with their psychology.
Okay, elaborate on that.
I say that to groups of, you know, I just finished a 2-day training, certification training in treating traumatic stress in San Diego yesterday. And the first time I say that with a room full of, you know, master's and PhD level clinicians, they just look at me with their head kind of sideways. And at the end of the second day, you know, I get a standing ovation. It's pretty cool stuff that the reason why human beings have distress is not because of their thoughts.
Okay.
That's 150 years of belief system that is just erroneous. The reason why people are distressed is because of what's in their bodies.
And that
distress is? Distress is muscle tension. That's what causes distress. It's not the thoughts. Thoughts are digital. Thoughts are just information. But that turns into physiology. That turns into distress and discomfort when a person perceives threat and there is no danger.
Right.
That's what is the rub right there.
But doesn't that start with the thoughts? What we
think? Seems logical, but the answer to that is no. What it starts with is painful learning. Anytime any human being has had any painful learning, any experience that has been painful, that experience is encoded and stored. And so the next time we encounter any situation that is in any way similar to that painful learning experience, what happens is the sensory memory from that painful experience comes forward and it hijacks our perceptual system and it causes us to perceive threat where there is no danger. We call that trauma when it's a capital T. Those are like the big dog things. You know, that's actual threat and death, sexual violence, or severe injury. That's what it takes to get PTSD. But there's also what we've kind of come to understand lowercase t traumas. And those are all of the painful learning experiences that we've ever had in our lives, physically or emotionally painful. When the future we step into any context that's anyway similar to that painful experience, we perceive threat in that experience. And when we perceive threat, our autonomic nervous system, it turns out that we live in an animal. Our autonomic nervous system responds to that perceived threat the way an animal responds to a perceived threat, is it jacks up the energy in the body of that animal, getting it ready to either kill whatever it is or run away from whatever it is.
That's really curious for me because I kind of have had a different approach to that my immediate reaction is based on my thought about a perceived threat. So this is very interesting to me, even though you and I have had so many conversations about all this stuff. It's a different approach even for me.
So watch this. Here's what really, this is a 15-year-old researcher. So that threat perception bypasses the neocortex. What that means is my body is already responding to the perceived threat in the environment presently, that my brain doesn't even know it yet. I'm not conscious of that before my body is already jacked up. And, you know, what we've learned in psychology in the past 10 years or so, that if a person stays in that jacked up state, if they stay in the context of a perceived threat and they do not intentionally relax the muscles of their body, what starts happening is they lose frontal lobe function. They lose their whole neocortical functioning, but primary neocortex, frontal lobe. And that's where all thinking happens. The intentional thought and identity and volition and impulse control and intelligence and creativity and relational skills, those are all frontal lobe functions. And if we stay in the context of a perceived threat and we do not relax the muscles of our body, we actually lose the hardware. It's not a software problem. It's a temporary loss of hardware.
Temporary.
Yeah. As soon as I get out of that situation, it all comes back and I go, boy, I was an idiot. I should have thought of this.
Right.
I should have remembered what I learned in my meeting. I should have remembered what I learned from my therapist. Except in that moment, they lost the hardware to be able to access it. It's not usable. It's there. It's just not accessible. The space collapsed.
So in our recovery process, we train ourselves to slow that down?
I think, you know, the new research, I think we're actually rebuilding it.
Okay.
I think 12-step fellowships are evolving our autonomic nervous system. Have you had anybody on your show that has talked about Stephen Porges' polyvagal response?
No.
Let me do that real briefly.
Okay.
It's pretty cool stuff. It's Stephen Porges at the University of South Carolina has been for the past 20 years kind of quietly working away on this stuff. And he's evolved the understanding of the autonomic nervous system out of the 20th century into the 21st century. And it's really interesting stuff. Are you familiar with Gabor Mate's work?
No, I'm not. Him?
He wrote one of the most definitive books on addiction over the past 10 years. It's called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And it's just beautiful. He's a recovering physician, and he went and lived with addicts in Victoria, BC, and he wrote about them. And he has kind of come forward and partnering with Stephen Porges of saying that the true cause of addiction is failed relationships.
Okay.
And so what Porges has kind of come to understand is we have a sympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system is our threat response system, right? You know, anytime that we perceive a threat, our body starts to jack itself up. Heart rate goes, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal, dumps a bunch of adrenaline and cortisol and cortisol and catecholamines and all of those chemicals. Our muscles constrict. Our digestive system shuts down. There's all of these physiological processes that happen when we perceive a threat. And then, you know, in the 20th century, we believed it was paired with a parasympathetic nervous system, which is relaxed and comfortable and peaceful and satiety and loving and kind and all of that stuff. And the parasympathetic is the nervous system that's supposed to run human beings' lives. There's the only thing that turns on all of that activation is because we're perceiving a threat. Well, what Stephen Porges has said is that there's two branches of this parasympathetic system. And there is a ventral system that is the vagus nerve that goes from your brain to your heart. And then there's this dorsal system that goes from your diaphragm all the way down to your perineum, down underneath all your stuff. And the human beings have this highly developed ventral system, which means that human beings are built to manage anxiety relationally. We are built to, when we have a bad day, when we're hurting, when we're struggling, we are built to turn to another human being and share about it. And if we grew up in families where our caregivers had relaxed bodies and our caregivers attuned to us when we were scared or hurting, that they were relaxed in a parasympathetic system and they were able to kind of, you know, when we got scared and we would come running in, they would go, sweetie, what's going on? And they would pick us up and hold us. And we felt them in a relaxed body. What happens is that autonomic nervous system discharges all of its anxiety. It resets.
Wow.
And that's called secure attachment. That's what that is secure attachment. And secure attachment is magical. It changes everything. But those children who grew up with anxious caregivers, volatile caregivers, of where they came back, they had been out exploring their little world and they came back to connect with the caregiver to get that secure attachment. And the caregiver said, I'm busy right now, leave me alone. Or made fun of the child or just was anxious. The child didn't get a chance to discharge. So the child's still in that state of constriction and pain. And it becomes chronic. There's no resetting. It's just chronic fear. It's chronic anxiety. And what that child has to learn to do is to peel off and go find ways to soothe that chronic state of discomfort because it's painful. Being jacked up like that all the time is painful. And I can remember from my own life, my first drug was I couldn't sleep at night because I was too jacked up. And what I would do is I'd get out of my bed and, you know, 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And I would spin around until I got so dizzy, I'd flop on my bed and the room would spin around and then I'd get up and I'd do it again. And I'd do it again. And I'd do it again until I passed out. And what that is the inability to use relational processes as a way of managing anxiety so that we peel off. And we find secretive, self-destructive ways to soothe. And then when we're 11, somebody says, here, try this.
I know for myself, relating to that, that I ended up looking at it like a big part of what I was trying to do when I started getting into the drugs and alcohol was to self-medicate to calm that down. Because I had to do something. I've actually had therapists tell me that if I hadn't had drugs and alcohol, I never would have made it. Because there was just too much of what you're talking about going on. And I had no place to turn for that secure attachment. Is that what you called it?
That's what it's called, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I didn't have that. So I created all kinds of ways. And that self-destruction part that you just brought into it, I say today that the root of all my addictions, because I've had all of them, is my addiction to self-destruction. Because every one of them, the outcome of any addiction that I've had to deal with, is about taking me down and taking me out of the loop, so to speak. So I can really relate to everything you're saying there.
And, you know, what I would say is you got the ball on the 5-yard line. Carrying the ball all the way into the end zone is starting to recognize that all the stuff that I did self-destructively was actually an attempt to help me.
Okay.
Everything that I did that was self-destructive, and I did a lot, was an attempt to get me out of that state of chronic jacked-upness, sympathetic dominance. It's untenable. People will kill themselves to get out of it. Human beings, no animal can live in chronic sympathetic nervous system activation. It is painful. It's constriction, and it compels the person to get out. And anybody who has ever been an addict, they'll tell you, how do you know you're an addict? Well, there was nothing I wouldn't do for one more hit.
Right.
And that's desperation. And what is it that you don't have if you don't have the hit? You got the body that is chronically constricted and so painful that they can't live in it. So it takes the person out to be able to use something. You know, all addiction, whether it is substance or process, is an attempt to regulate a dysregulated autonomic nervous system.
Wow. One of the things that I've had a difficult time communicating with people that have never, quote unquote, been there is when I was at the worst of my suicidal tendencies, where I could not escape the thought of my eyes were open. A lot of people do not understand the physical pain that comes with that. Most people think it's all mental and that you should be able to just change your mind, and I couldn't. I could not just change my mind. And what made it as bad for me as it was I had just enough mind left and I had enough recovery behind me when I got there that I kept telling myself, you should know better. You should be able to do better. You've got all these tools. Why aren't you using them? Well, I was trying like hell to use them. And I was too caught up in that jacked upness that you're talking about. And I just couldn't. I just couldn't.
That's right. You could not. There was no space between stimulus and response. You were compelled against your will.
Right.
And that is the best definition that we got for demoralization.
Right. And I'm glad you used that word, because a big part of what took me down was my codependency. And it was so incredible. It was so humiliating in my mind that I knew the tools. And I knew what I was doing. I was conscious that I was looking for this other person to make me better. And I was also aware that she was never going to be able to do that. But I was absolutely powerless over not trying to manipulate her into doing what I thought she needed to do so I would be okay. She became my drug. She became that thing that was going to make it okay. And it was incredibly demoralizing.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that that is the opposite of spirit. Is dependency is the opposite of spirituality.
On anything.
On anything. That's right. And Jung would agree with me on that.
Well, good.
Let me bring this all the way to close, because it's really cool when you factor this in. So the child that grows up and gets launched into adolescence with this dorsal vagal activation, which is the peeling off, they've had so many painful experiences in their development in vis-a-vis relationships. With their primary developmental relationships, is they now perceive threat relationally from other people. Their judgment and the way that somebody will articulate that is, I don't feel like I belong. I feel like I'm an alien. I feel like I'm different than everybody else. That's what dorsal vagal activation feels like. And so there's constant peeling away. When bad things happen, there is not the engagement. There is isolation. And then in that isolation, the person uses whatever it is that they use. Maybe money, maybe sex, maybe power, prestige. It may be drugs or alcohol. But they're using something to be able to manage their discomfort. Whereas the child that had secure attachment, they go to junior high school and get slammed. And they step to a friend and say, can I talk to you about what happened today? And they share with their friend and they get relief. And they're able to do that all the way through their lives. They're able to use the relational connection as a way of minimizing or lessening anxiety. But here's what's lovely about that, is that those of us who are the sickest and have gone the furthest down in our addiction, we're the ones that get grace, because we end up having to go to a 12-step fellowship.
Right.
And, you know, the first time that we're belly aching at a meeting and saying how bad things are, you know, somebody looks at us and says, call your sponsor. You know, reach out to another human being.
Right.
Anybody who's ever had any clean time can tell you what happens the first time that we pick up that phone and we reach out to somebody.
Right. And I believe one of the beauties of the 12-step fellowships is the connectedness that goes on.
That's right. Because, so let me ask you, the first time you picked up a telephone and you called another person in recovery, what happened in your body when you did that after you called?
I settled. I settled down.
That's right.
Yeah. It was like, oh my God, somebody else has gotten through this.
That's
so
right.
It gave me, to tie it back to the beginning of what you were saying, it gave me hope. Talking to somebody that had already been there, and that's the other thing I wanted to say earlier, I didn't get to it, was hope for me was very frightening. It was incredibly frightening. And as a matter of fact, part of my healing process was my dad wouldn't let me dream. Anytime I would say, well, I could do this or I could do that, he would try to talk me out of believing whatever that was could happen. And I used to be so angry with him about that. But finally, in my own recovery, what I realized was, in his experience, in his life, hope always brought him disappointment and heartache and pain. So in essence, what he was trying to do was to save me that pain.
He was loving you.
Yeah, he was. He was like, look, son, this is never going to work out. Please don't experience all the pain that I've experienced from hoping.
That's right.
And so today I can look at that, getting teared up here. Today I can look at that and realize that there's a line in A Course in Miracles that says, all interactions between two people is either an expression of love or a call for love. And my dad was screaming for me to love him. And at the same time, he was terrified to believe that love was possible. Because in his experience, love always ended up hurting him. So the only thing he had to do to love me with was to try to help me avoid that pain.
Yep.
So when I changed my mind and my perception of what was going on to where he wasn't the ogre in my life that was just there to destroy my life, that he was somebody that was really trying to love me, but he was coming from such a dysfunctional way of trying to express that love, it allowed me to love him. So I love everything you've said.
From over here in the choir, please hear a loud and glorious amen.
I got to say this, and this is kind of off of what we're talking about right now, but one of the things I look back on my time of you being my therapist and my step coach and all that, I remember one time something was going on, and you asked me where that was coming from. And I came off with this story, and you looked at me with that smirk that you get, and you said, man, how long have you been rehearsing that shit? And I thought about it after you said that, and it was like, I had learned how to tell my traumatic stories about my traumatic life in a way to manipulate people. If I could get you to connect with my being a victim and get you to quote unquote feel bad for me, I was more apt to get you to do whatever it was I thought you needed to do for me in the moment. So I've had to, in my recovery process, I've had to look at how I tell my stories, how I use my stories, and how to disconnect from them and start to see them in a different light. So in that space, the situation that I talk about is the same that I talked about all along, but I'm coming from a different perception of it. You don't end up feeling sorry for me. As a matter of fact, people that I tell the stories to today end up like, wow, that's powerful, because I'm coming from a place of loving my dad and not being afraid of my dad, not hating my dad, because I've turned it all around. And that way I can go into that space that you're talking about of like not reacting to everything and having a moment of like, no, wait a minute, there's got to be another way to see this. And I don't have to do what I've always done. One of the things that I've encountered a lot in my attempts to help other people is I ask them, well, why'd you do that? Well, that's the way I've always done it. Well, has it always worked for you? You know, so let's try to learn a new way to do it. And I think that a big part of my recovery has been about mind training and training myself to see things different, to feel, because if I can think about them different, I will feel about them different. If I feel about them different, my behavior about them is going to be different. If my behavior changes, my life changes. I don't know how that ties into all that you were saying, but I do think that we're pretty much on the same page. We might just have a little different verbiage about it.
I'm certain of it. I'm certain of it. You know, the miracle, you know, you were talking about Course in Miracles, and what the Course in Miracles articulates pretty nicely is that the miracle happens when there is genuine connection between another human being. And when there is that connection, that attachment between another human being, then what happens is there is the lowering of arousal, of anxiety. There is this activation of the ventral vagal system, and there is a sense of safety and comfort in that moment. And what happens is that's when you are now able to get different perceptions and be able to change the way that you perceive yourself in the world, which leads to the behavior changes. And that's what 12-step fellowships have to teach psychology, is that we have kind of, in the 12-step world, perfected that relational process of using the support. It's without parallel, is the ability of one recovering person helping another is without parallel. You know, there's nothing else that's more powerful than that. And what's really cool is the research, the physiological research over the past 5 or 6 or 8 years has shown that to be true. And so that when we connect with another human being, that we find ourselves being able to be regulated and we find ourselves having transformation. And I just love that a dope fiend and a drunk in a hotel lobby in 1935 in Akron, Ohio, figured out really good cognitive behavioral therapy.
That
this process is that all that's happening in it is deeply plumbed in the psychophysiology process. But it, up here on the surface, it's about connection to another human being. And in that process, I can begin to connect to spirit. And so spirit works as the connection when there is not another human being around. So that being able to do both of those two things of having an intrapersonal, I love that the word enthusiasm is drawn from enteos, which is God within.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's the root of the word, the etymology of that. Spirit internally gives a person juice to be able to confront the stuff that they're afraid of. And confronting stuff that you're afraid of in a relaxed body is how you have quality of life. That is, I mean, if there's anything to be done to completely change your quality of life, is learning how to be in a relaxed muscle body while you are confronting the myriad, the thousand things during your day that you perceive as threatening.
You know, you just gave me another piece as to the importance of those letters that I wrote, because what they were doing was connecting me to spirit, which in my mind is a higher thought and a connected thought to whatever my source is, your source is. We all call it something different, but it doesn't matter what you call it as long as it's there and you're turning to it. So in writing those letters and getting connected to that, it helped me have, and I keep going back to this thing about that space that you talked about, because going back to that space and having that moment before the reaction and having that connected to spirit, or even taking the time to call someone and being connected to them. But the connectivity that can happen in that space is where lives change.
That's right. Now, here's the ultimate rub and the thing that I wanted to make sure got said today. Here is the linchpin of the connection. I can teach somebody to get their muscles relaxed. And when a person relaxes their muscles, they have comfort in their body. They are no longer in distress. They have maximal neocortical functioning, which means they can be creative and intelligent, and they can be intentional instead of reactive. They can act and say, they can say what they mean and mean what they say without saying it mean. You know, they can act the way that they want to be. But here's the rub. people who have been hypervigilant their whole lives, and they have coped with their pain and fear by staying in a state of jacked up hypervigilance. What it takes for them to be able to now develop relaxed vigilance and go forward in a fully functioning system that is in a comfortable body is that it requires spiritual maturation. It requires that for the next 5 minutes, that if I'm not going to hold on, man, I'm not going to squeeze my way and brute force my way through this situation, I got to trust that the universe is not going to fall on my head in the next 5 seconds so that I can let go. And what happens is that every time I let go and the universe doesn't fall on my head, then what starts happening over a multiple year process is what Carl Jung talked about at the end of his life, is when Dick Cavett asked him on the Cavett Show, Dr. Jung, he said, you know, well, there's been all this kind of talk about you're an atheist or that you're a believer and nobody ever really knows. And Dr. Jung, I just want to come out and ask you, do you believe? And Carl Jung, the spiritual father of the 12 steps, so Bill called him, took his pipe, and, you know, this is back in the day, so he could smoke. He was cleaning out his pipe, and he was filling his pipe, and he lit his pipe, and he took a hit, and he sat there, and he said, believe? No, I don't believe. I know.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, there's a big difference in believing and knowing.
That's where that process, that's what spiritual maturation leads to, is a knowing. And when you know that you are connected to something greater than you,
right.
And when you know that you've had enough experiences that things work out better when I trust,
right.
That provides the antidote to walking around in a perceivedly dangerous world. And that's how you be healthy in a toxic environment. And our world is a toxic environment. And how do you be healthy? Well, you got to have connection with other human beings, and you got to have some type of connection to a principle that's higher and greater than you. Eric Greitens, Navy SEAL, author, Rhodes Scholar, governor of Missouri now, quote from his book is, the reason why you are suffering is because you don't know what you're doing here.
Oh, man. I love that, Eric. I love that. You know, I'm going to tie this back into what you just said to a piece that you helped me with back in the day. You kept telling me that I had to face my fears, that I needed to quit running from them, and I needed to quit fighting them, and I needed to just stand and be with them. And at that time, I was having so many panic attacks. It was like it was a constant panic attack for me. And one night, part of what was happening for me was I was terrified I wasn't going to go to sleep, because sleep deprivation was killing me. And at the same time, I was terrified to go to sleep because I knew when I woke up, I was going to wake up in a panic attack. So one night I was just consumed with all of that. And I laid down on my couch and I said, okay, I'm just going to lay here with this. What am I really afraid of? And at that time, the thought that came to mind was I was afraid of going back to the mental ward and having to do the electroconvulsive shock treatments again. That fear paralyzed me. And I had that thought while I was laying there trying to face the fear. And then I thought, you've already done that. And you survived it. So bring it on. What's next? And then my next thought was I was going to lose my girlfriend. And my thought behind that was, you're here alone. She's already gone. So I don't need to be afraid of losing what I don't have. So I laid there and I realized that my perceived threats, using your phrase, and they are perceived threats, wasn't anything I really needed to be afraid of, because it wasn't anything I couldn't survive. So what started happening for me after that, because I was doing all kinds of work to build self-confidence and self-care, what happened for me after that is I started collecting evidence to prove that my perceived threats weren't real. So in that place and simultaneously writing those letters, at that time I was writing those letters 4 and 5 times a day, actually. But through that and building that connection with source, I slowly, and it was slow. I tell people today to write these letters and they'll write 2 or 3 letters and they'll say, I'm not feeling better. And I'm like, well, you know what? This ain't like taking a pill. You know, you got to work on changing that inner dialogue and your self-talk, because right now your self-talk is killing you. And it was really important for me, though, that you kept drilling into my head that I had to stand with that fear so I could realize that it wasn't anything I really needed to be afraid of. So that was a very important part of this talk we've had and important part of my growth. And it's a big part of why I can do these shows today and be able to have these incredible conversations with people like yourself. It's so cool for me because it's like going to a therapy session, and it's really powerful the way my life is today. If it hadn't have been for all that stuff that I did, I never would have written Dragons to Butterflies. And I'm living my dream right now, and it's because I did the stuff. And just this one last thing about, you know, I work with a lot of people today. I'm bipolar too, and I work with several people today that have that. And one of the biggest things I run into is people approach their medication as though their medication is going to make them happy. And after they've taken the medication for 3 or 4 days and they're not euphoric, the medication's not working. And what I tell people is the medication is not supposed to make you happy. It's supposed to balance your brain chemistry enough that you can do the work to get happy. But so many want that quick fix. And if they don't get the quick fix, then the medication's not working. So I tell people today, you would have to beat me up to get me not to take my medication, because I like being able to think, you know, and I can't, I don't have that connection anywhere with anything if I don't have the medication to balance my brain chemistry. And to me, that's a big part of where the psychology of things and the spirituality of things is important, why I need both. Because some people get way off into the spirituality thing and they're like, if you just believed in God enough, you wouldn't have to take that medication. And I'm like, no, I need to take the medication so I can believe in God. And so I'm not just running on my own insane thinking. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, sure does. I would correct that medication doesn't have a thing to do with psychology.
Okay.
It has everything to do with medicine and psychiatry.
Okay.
But not psychology.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I appreciate that. The other thing that helps me out immensely is I try to live in the space of there's always a possibility that I'm wrong. And in that space, I can always be learning. But when I get locked into this is the way something is, I've totally shut myself out to learning there might be a better way.
Yes. My partner, Bob Roten, we own Arizona Trauma Institute and Trauma Institute International together. And his mantra, his mission in life is to suck a little bit less today than I did yesterday.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, Eric, I'm watching the clock here, and we need to wrap this up. So I want you to tell all the listeners how they can find you, how they can connect with you, your books. I mean, I know you've got too many books to probably go over all of them, but I know there's a site where they can go and find all your books and everything about you. So just let everybody know how they can reach you.
Probably the easiest to remember would be www.forwardfacing.com. My newest book is Forward Facing Trauma Therapy, Healing the Moral Wound, that came out last year. And so I just made a website for the book, and it's got all my contact information on there. It has my Phoenix contact information. I also have the website CompassionUnlimited.com. And you can use email is j.eric.gentry.phd@gmail.com. So any of those will find me. And, you know, one of the things that I always say every time I do a training is that my mission on this planet is to help people, who are suffering or traumatized. So if anybody is listening to this and would like to need some consultation or any way that I can serve you, then you are welcome to contact me and I'll help any way I can.
Great. Thank you. I just want the listeners to know that our intention, Eric and I, is to revisit our conversation in 8 weeks and to build upon it from what we've already done today. And because the truth is, I could sit and talk with Eric all day, and I know you guys aren't going to listen to that. So about 45 minutes is about all you can take. But we will be doing it again. And I just want to thank all the listeners for being here with us today. And I want to thank Eric, and I want to thank Mental Health News Radio Network for providing a platform for Eric and I to have our voices heard. So thank you very much, and I hope you have a great day. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, never give up, always keep it real, and take time to smell the roses, and please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.